Hello. Good to see you guys all here this morning. If you don't know me, my name is Adam Smith, and I am the pastor here at Venue 2. And we're so glad that you're here with us. I almost tripped over nothingness. Did you guys see that? Wow. Wait till I really get going, then I'm going to fall off the stage. We're so glad you're here, especially if you're new with us. We want you to know that maybe you haven't been to church in a long time, or maybe you kind of just feel like church really isn't your thing. And I just want you to know you are in the right place, because we organize our entire service to connect with you, to build an environment that makes sense to everyone so that you can grow in your faith and get to know who God is and ask questions about who God is. And so that's where you're at. You're in a safe place, and we are so excited that you're here. Can we just make a little bit of noise for all of our first-time people? You may also notice that they can be kind of a rowdy bunch. Also, you're in a bar, so just... Those two things kind of go together a little bit. So we like to just kind of keep it rowdy and have a lot of fun. We just believe that church ought to be a place where people enjoy themselves and look forward to coming every single week. And so we're continuing on this series today called Things I Wish Jesus Never Said. And then next week, we're going to be jump-starting a series called The Big Ask. And actually, on each of your tables is an invite card that on the front just has our times and stuff like that in case you want to invite somebody. On the back, it just says, does this invite make my ask look big? And some of you immediately enjoy that. Some of you are offended by that. Apparently, that could sound like something else. I'm not really sure because I don't listen to a lot of rap music that the kids are into these days. But I would just say if that offends you, then just leave it on the table and don't use it. But if it's something that you're like, man, that could be a conversational piece, but I could get somebody to be like, really, a church put that out? That would be interesting. I want to see what that's about. Take a bunch with you. Invite people. This series is going to be incredible. And so that all jump starts next week. And so this week we're going to jump in. Can we bring the lights up just a pinch? And on your tables, there are some note sheets and some pens I think just pens and pencils. And so I want to encourage you to take notes, write down something that stands out to you today. Normally we have everything on slides, but we've got a little technical issue, and so we don't. So today, you'll feel free to copy off the paper of the person next to you. That's illegal here in church. Or if you really like something, if you're just like, man, that was good. Amen. I like it. Repeat. Then I'll just do that. Okay, so that'll help along the way. And the title of my message this morning is this: The Blessing of a Bully. The Blessing of a Bully. Has anybody ever seen this series of videos on YouTube called Chuck E. Cheese Fights? I'm judging by the muffled laughter that many of you have not had the pleasure, okay? And I'm telling you, you are missing out. Don't do it right now, okay? But eventually, sometime this afternoon, you're just in for a treat, okay? Pop yourself some popcorn, sit down with some YouTube, and watch something called Chuck E. Cheese Fights. It is a series of videos that are taped on people's phones of parents raging on each other. Right? It already sounds amazing. Some of you are tempted to Google it right now, but don't do it. Just wait till after, okay? It's amazing. It's some of the most abrasive stuff I've ever seen happen in a children's play place, okay? Just parents that, like, one kid started taunting another kid, and a parent stepped in, and it turned heated, and it got crazy. And these things turn into all-out brawls. There are some of these videos where there's, like, 50 people fighting each other at a Chuck E. Cheese over which kid gets to use, like, the Big Bertha game where you throw the ball in the like, lady's mouth. I mean, you're like, things have gotten a little bit out of control. And, I mean, you got people stomping each other and punching each other, just out of control, chaotic. And like, as crazy as that sounds, part of me kind of gets it, you know? Because I have children. And I don't know if you know this, but parents can get a little testy when their kids are being taunted, okay? Have you noticed this? How many of you can get a little aggressive when you feel like somebody is picking on your kid, okay? Anybody in here? Some other people next to you are like, get your hand up. You know you're on that Chuck E. Cheese video. They're gonna find out sooner or later. They Google your name. And like, and I'm it never ceases to amaze me, like the kind of mild-mannered people that will just snap when somebody messes with their kid. You could take like the most calm homeschool mom, right? And she's all nice and, you know, and everything's pleasant and good, and they're on a nature walk, and somebody starts messing with their kid, and suddenly she turns into a wildebeest, right? She's going angry and just like, don't mess with my baby! Right? And you're like, whoa, I'm sorry, you know? It just, like, the escalation is so quickly. You go from, like, nothing to, like, curb stomping somebody at a Chuck E. Cheese and, like, zero to six, just, like, instantaneously. It's just out of control. You watch mild-mannered dads, like just an accountant who always kind of fades to the background. And somebody messes with his kid, and suddenly he is ready to throw down. He's taking his glasses off, gingerly folding them up, and then ripping his shirt and like ready to, because you know when those glasses are expensive. So we just snap, and like that makes sense to me because I have kids too. Recently my daughter, who last year she's in first grade. And she was coming home, and she was talking about there was these couple kids that were picking on her at school. And there's something like when your kid comes home and starts telling you stories, and you're like, okay, tell me more about that. And as she's telling me, I like get up out of my chair. I'm starting to pace around, starting to get a little frustrated, starting to think about like if a prison term is worth it. You know what I mean? For like a six-year-old, right? I mean, a 6 or 7-year-old. And so I decided I'm going to sign up and I'm going to go volunteer at this school and check it out for myself. That's always a bad move when you do it out of anger. I will serve out of rage, right? Like that's never going to a good place. And so I decided I'm going to like sign up. I go to this school and I'm hanging out and I'm watching. I know the kids that it is. And so I'm watching from a distance. And sure enough, even with me there in the room or on the edge of the playground, they try and do some stuff, and I'm just like, are you kidding me? I'm right here, right? Like, just as the day is progressing, I just start planting myself over near these kids, right, just to kind of be around them, and there's this one exchange that happens. It wasn't even with my kid, but there was this thing that happened where this little girl who I know has been messing with my daughter messed with this other kid, and there was, like, something in my head, like, all these scenarios played out. I don't know if this has ever happened to you before, but where you're just, like, all these evil things pop up, and you're just like, oh, I'd definitely go to prison. You know what I mean? Like, where you're just like, is it wrong to just punch a 6-year-old? You know what I mean? Like, because there's that thing. And that's weird because you're like, I know it's wrong, but is it really wrong? I mean, under the circumstances. You know, like, you're trying to compromise and talk yourself into it because you're just so frustrated. And I was like resisting. And finally there was this moment where I'm playing Foursquare and this girl just like shames this other girl in front of me. And I was just so upset. And Tegan had told me a similar story that happened to her. And there was just kind of that moment where I just couldn't contain it anymore. Where this girl is like, you know, all pompous, getting ready to walk away. And she turns to face me and she kind of catches me like, he saw me do that. And I just did the like, just the crazy eyes, you know what I mean? Which is even crazier because I'm a large bearded man, if you haven't noticed. And it's just like, this guy is part beast and he will kill me, right? And I want to say I feel bad about that, but I kind of didn't, right? I mean, I was just like, I wanted to scare and intimidate her. And there was this thing, as I looked over at Tegan, she had this giant smile on her face, like, yeah, that's right. Do it again. Just try him. Oh, yeah, pull out all your stops with my dad here. And that girl didn't do anything else. But Tegan was loving life, right? Because it was like, man, if anything gets ready to happen, my dad's going to step in. My dad's going to protect me. My dad's going to make sure that there are no consequences here, that like nothing turns sour, that like I don't have to suffer. And there's a comfort in that. There's this protection that she ends up feeling. And see, what I think is interesting is when we are children, some of our first ideas about who God is come from our parents. We naturally kind of assign traits that we observe in our parents to God. And this can be both a positive and a negative thing, depending on what kind of upbringing you had, depending on what kind of observations you made growing up of your parents, of other parents, of a parent you wish you would have had. And we start to kind of cobble together this idea of who God is. And in fact, Jesus calls God Father. And so it's not entirely a bad thing to do. But we can begin to take all of these expectations we have of an earthly parent, and maybe they're distorted, maybe they're not, and we can begin to place all those same expectations onto God. And we don't even often realize we're doing it until something kind of happens that disappoints one of those expectations. Those things that we expected, like, you know what? Good dads do this. Good gods do this. And when that thing doesn't happen, when it doesn't pan out, when it doesn't actually come about the way we thought it was, that can really crush our hearts. It can kind of stomp on our souls a little bit. I wonder if something like that has ever happened to you, where you kind of hit a moment where you kind of thought, man, you know, if he was a good God, he would have stepped in there. If he was a good God, like he would have flinched. He would have made crazy eyes. He would have stepped up. He would have intervened. He would have absorbed the consequences of this circumstance or situation. Like, if he was really a good God, he would have done the thing that I wanted him to do. And I wonder if you've ever had a moment in which you were waiting around for God to step in and he just didn't. It didn't happen. And I think these are the kinds of moments in which a lot of people lose faith. Maybe it's when you lost yours. Maybe it's something that's still mending or recovering. Maybe you're not sure you want it to. Maybe you had a marriage that you thought God was going to step in and patch it up and turn that person's heart, but then the whole thing fell apart. Maybe you're in a job that you really thought was your dream job, but it wasn't kind of gelling, and you prayed that God would really see the real situation and what was actually happening there and not the lies that are being told, and yet it kind of disintegrated and just kind of fell through your fingers. Or maybe it was a situation with one of your kids where, you know, they kind of had this season where they walked away and you just thought, God, you're going to bring them back, and they're not back. And we're devastated. And we're disillusioned in these moments. And what do we do about that? And what I think is interesting is Jesus actually addresses these presuppositions, these expectations that we have. In fact, like, one of the big goals of Jesus during his earthly ministry was to reintroduce us to our Heavenly Father, to the Heavenly Father that, like, religion had begun to distort a picture of. And so Jesus stands up and he begins to deliver his very first sermon ever. And as he begins to deliver the sermon, he's speaking to people in ancient Israel during a time in which they understand what it is to be oppressed, to be bullied, to come home and tell stories about things that happened that shouldn't have happened, about things that occurred in relationships that really shouldn't have gone down, things that shamed them, that hurt them. You're talking about an occupied country at this time in history in which the Romans are actually living in among the people and oppressing them. The Romans have rights far above the Jewish people. In fact, they can make them do all sorts of things. They take their money. They overtax them. Up towards 80% of their income is taken by the Romans and split up amongst the government and the soldiers. These people know what it's like to be oppressed, mocked and made fun of for their religious beliefs, obstructed on their way to the temple. This was the life that they lived. But they had this thought, this promise that God would send a Messiah, that God would send someone who was God in human form to put the world back together again, to rescue us. They thought, like a good father, God is going to step in. He's going to overthrow these people. He's going to put them in their place. Like, he'll use his power against the people that have used their power against us. Like, he'll put an end to all of this madness. Like, he'll make everything smooth for us and easy and prosperous. And then we'll be the ones in power. And then we'll be the ones that get to make the decisions. We'll be the ones who are in control because we're doing what's right. And that wins, right? And so Jesus steps up in front of this crowd of people, Jews and Gentiles, believers and non-believers, all huddled together on the side of this hill. And he steps up, and as these people hold their breath, Jesus begins to give a speech that will become his defining moment. And what he says
is the opposite of what everyone expects to hear. It was inverted. It was upside down. It was counterintuitive. And honestly, it was flat out offensive to these people. And this is what he says. Matthew chapter 5, verse 10. In a series of statements about what it is that God blesses, he says this. God blesses those who are persecuted for doing right, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. God blesses those who are persecuted for doing right, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. What? No, like, what, Jesus, what are you doing? I brought friends today, okay? Like, cut out that part. I mean, they don't want to hear, like, they don't want to hear what you're saying. They don't want to be like, oh, hey, guys, sorry about your persecution, but when you come to think about it, it might actually be awesome for you, right? Like, that's not what anyone wants to hear you say. Like, I thought you were going to try and build a movement. This isn't really the way to do that. I mean, like, here's the thing. We're all looking to avoid persecution. Maybe you didn't get the memo. Okay, that's fine. We'll give you a second shot at this one. Like, I mean, it's just like, it's kind of the main reason why we're attracted to your whole thing here. This kind of idea that we thought that you were going to stop all of the persecution. We thought you were going to rescue us. We thought you were going to pull us out. We thought you were going to, like, make all these people pay, that you were going to insulate us and prevent anything bad from happening to us. We thought you were going to pay these fools back for what they did to us. You know what I'm talking about. To put us, the actual good guys, in our rightful place. And sure, like, don't get me wrong, I want to do the right thing. But, like, not if it's going to cost me. I mean, I'll make you a deal, Jesus. I'll promise to try and do the right thing if you promise me that I'll never suffer for it. Because it just doesn't seem fair. I mean, it feels like if you do the right thing, then everything should just turn out all right. I mean, that makes sense to me. Why don't you turn that into a beatitude? That sounds amazing. But life doesn't actually work like that, does it? In fact, we've all probably had this instance in our lives in which we denied our self-indulgent impulses and we gritted our teeth and we tried to live honestly and with integrity and generosity and humility and mercy, and we lost. You lost money, you lost friends, you lost a job, you lost an opportunity. Nobody celebrated you. Nobody referred to you as a hero. Nobody told you what an incredible Christian you are for what you just did and thanked you for being the right kind of person who always does the right kind of thing. It just didn't happen. Like you did the right thing, and it felt like you were left with less than what you started with. And it just kind of feels unfair. Has that ever happened to you before? Maybe you tried to kind of remain humble and just like do a good job with whatever you were given to do, and you put in extra time and effort to try and make it like just awesome, as great as you could make it. And guess what? You didn't get the promotion that they promised you, that they dangled in front of your face to get you to take on the overtime. Like, they didn't even give it to you. They gave it to that other guy who's always like talking and schmoozing and like telling stories behind other people's backs and like, you know, taking credit for other people's work. Don't you love people who do that? Exaggerating how much they're really contributing around here. Like, how come that guy gets the promotion? He doesn't even do anything. We're the ones doing all the work. He shouldn't get rewarded. Why am I being punished for doing the right thing? Or maybe for you, like, you found yourself in the midst of kind of this us and them type situation where lines were drawn and everybody picked sides and you were pressured to kind of pick one side or the other. But you listened and you validated and you challenged both sides because you kind of felt like you were on every side because you see yourself as a peacemaker and you want to see people reconciled and you want to see relationships restored, but that didn't happen. Instead, now both sides want nothing to do with you. Because you refused to alienate one group, both groups now alienate you. And now you're on the outside looking in for trying to do the right thing. Or maybe for you, like, you went to forgive somebody that really hurt you, and it took you a long time to kind of work up to that place. And so you went to own your own part of the feud and make things right, and it was really hard to swallow your pride and to say all those things to them. And they were just kind of like, oh, man, I'm so sorry you have a problem with me, but I didn't do anything wrong. And then they made you feel like you were crazy for even bringing it up. And then they like dug into you and made you feel small, and all these feelings that you thought you'd already dealt with flooded to the surface, and you felt sick, and you just thought, this is not how it was supposed to go down. I tried to do the right thing here. And in all these instances, we think like, I did the right thing, and it blew up in my face. It didn't make things better. It made things worse. Like, people didn't embrace it. They pushed back against it. And you see, the truth is, the way of Jesus seriously threatens the way the world works. The way of Jesus seriously threatens the way the world works. It claims that there's a better way than the way that we've always done it. And guess what? Not everyone is ready to wake up to that reality. People don't always want to hear Jesus' perspective because it challenges the perspective they've been clinging to for so long. And the thought of everything that you've built your life on being pulled out from underneath you is terrifying. It's so scary. And when people are scared, they lash out. They push back. They oppress. They persecute. And Jesus looks these people in the eye who are experiencing all of this firsthand to extremes we probably couldn't imagine in our modern world. And he says, you're blessed. A word that actually means in the original Greek, you're lucky. You're fortunate. You're to be envied. You're given a gift that's absolutely priceless, right? Yeah. And everyone's like, I don't like this Jesus guy. But he doesn't leave it there. And this is what's awesome about Jesus. He keeps going. Verse 11, he says this, God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you because you're my followers. Have you ever been talking to somebody before and they make a point and they're like, and it kind of stings a little bit, but they don't stop there and just let it sit? They just keep going and going and going and just like rubbing vinegar into the wound. And you're just like, I got it! They just keep pushing it. That's what's happening here. Thanks, Jesus. So here's the thing. Let me dig into what these people are actually hearing him say. Because when you look at these words in the original language in which Jesus spoke them, they pack this huge punch. I mean, they feel insulting enough as is. But if we dive into them, it's even worse. The word mock, the word that's translated as mock, means this: to criticize, to insult, to belittle, to make a joke of, to stab at with abusive words, to angrily email employing the all caps and or extensive use of exclamation points. It's the original language. I got this out of a commentary, guys. It's kind of the idea of never being taken seriously when you're in the presence of that person. It's always a joke to them. You're a joke to them. They know how to like posture themselves and like the things that they say and the questions that they ask in this way that kind of makes you just feel small and stupid and insignificant. They know how to make your passions seem ridiculous. The word persecute here means this. It means to pursue or to prosecute. To pursue or to prosecute. Ever felt like somebody just like had it out for you? They just wouldn't let it go? Just like they're in hot pursuit of just destroying you. It just feels like that. Like they won't stop until they make you pay. And at a certain point, you forget what you're supposed to be paying for, right? Like you don't even remember what it is that they're upset about. Maybe you never really knew. And they're just hounding you. They just won't drop it. And it's like every time you turn around, they're there.
trying to get at you or take you down, and you're just like, what is their deal? The word lie means this: to make things up and attribute them to you. To make things up and attribute them to you. Anybody ever spread a rumor about you that wasn't even close to being true? Like, that literally never happened. Nothing even close to it. It means to cheat, to defraud. This is my favorite one. To negatively shape a perception by telling only half the story. Ever had that happen to you? Where someone's like, well, I heard that you, and you're like, that's not totally, here's the deal. You only heard part of it, right? But you've already been painted in this corner as being this certain type of a person. This is when, like, someone tells people that you said or did things you didn't. It's when people question your motives. They judge not only what you did, but why they think you might have done it, which they couldn't possibly know. Oh, sure, they did that, and that seems kind of good. But if you knew their, like, horrible motives behind it, let me tell you some stories. It's that sort of a situation. It's prejudice. It's when people form this opinion of you, and no matter what you do, that's always who they see you to be. And when you do something that strays outside of the box that they built for you, they just write it off. They push it out of the way. This last part, what translates into say all sorts of evil things against you, means to corrupt other people toward you. This is where you've moved beyond just mocking and persecuting the person. It's where they have such an issue with you and who you are and the decisions that you've made that their hatred or their angst or their contempt has gotten to such a point where it starts to spread to others. And other people that were once with you are now against you because of their conversations with these people. And Jesus is saying that when you do the right thing and people mock you for it, poke fun at you, throw shade on you via Facebook. Maybe I've listened to a couple rap songs. Okay. Whisper behind your back. Trash you on like a private group text that you suddenly like get wind of, spread lies, turn friends, family members, coworkers against you. When all of this stuff happens, Jesus is saying, trust me, there's a blessing buried in there. And then he says this, he just keeps going. This is so great. Verse 12, be happy about it. Be very glad. Like, this translates as like, be grateful, appreciative, joyful, dance about it. It literally means you're so happy, you are dancing about it. This is where half the audience just left. They're like, we're out of here. Call us when you got some loaves and fishes to split. Then he says this, for a great reward awaits you in heaven. And this is what I would have thought if I was sitting out on the side of that hill that day. Probably what some of you are thinking. That's great. A reward awaits you in heaven. So what about now? What about right now? Because right now is horrible. I don't know if I'm going to survive today. And here's what he's saying. He's saying that there are going to be times when you're trying to be a presence of Jesus in this world, where it's going to be hard and it's going to be painful and it will cost you, and you will end up asking yourself, is this really worth it? I'm like, am I seriously going to try and do the right thing here? Because like, the more I try to do what's right, it just seems like the more things go wrong. I mean, what is the point of all this? I mean, it creates all kinds of kickback in my life. There's no way I'm going to forgive that person after what they did. It's going to be too painful. There's no way I'm turning the other cheek. It's ridiculous. Like, there's no way I'm going to bless people that curse me. Are you crazy? I'm done being honest in a situation where just lying would benefit me so much more. I'm like, doing the Jesus thing is screwing everything up for me. It's getting in the way. all my friends and coworkers and everything, I mean, they're all moving in this direction and like trying to go against the flow. It's just going to bring up all this other stuff that I just don't want to deal with. I just kind of wonder, like, is the Jesus thing really worth it? Now, something I'd like to point out before we move on is that this. Notice he says this. He says that you're blessed when you're persecuted for doing right and following Jesus. Doing right and following Jesus. But ironically, like a sign that you're actually following Jesus is to refuse to assume that anything that doesn't go your way is a result of persecution because you're doing right and following Jesus. Living with humility means that you vigorously search your own soul for error first. Like when something goes wrong, you're not just like, well, that's probably the devil because I'm doing everything right. Persecution. Guess I'll just take up my cross today. But we probably all know people who do that, right? Like people who are deluded into believing that any inconvenience is religious persecution. And you're just like, what are you talking about? Sometimes cars just break down, okay? It happens. Sometimes you don't get the last cinnamon roll, okay? Like, it doesn't mean, you know what I mean? Or maybe it's to another extreme where, like, the issues are otherly, in which, like, you know, they're like, well, you know, I'm just being persecuted because of Jesus. No, not really. You're being persecuted because you're a jerk, okay? Let's just be real. I mean, bless your heart, everyone else knows but you. I mean, like, you kind of had it coming. No one likes you. And it's for very valid reasons that have nothing to do with the Lord, okay? Well, I've been persecuted because I just told the truth. No, you viciously attack somebody on Facebook, okay? That's different. And you use an alias and misquoted scripture twice, okay? Well, I just took a stand. No, you grandstanded, okay? There's a difference. Instead of just like quietly removing yourself from something that you kind of felt convicted about, you made a scene and you pointed fingers on the way out the door and tried to put people in their place and tell them what to do, assuming that, like, you know, God made everybody just like you. Well, I was just arguing on behalf of God. That's why I'm being persecuted. No, you weren't. You were pompously protecting your own pride. And you got cocky and it got ugly. I love how little eye contact there is in the room right now. Everyone's like, don't look at her. If we don't catch her gaze, maybe she won't know. We know how much she needs this. Shh, don't breathe. So here's the thing. What does Jesus mean when he says that those who suffer persecution, that the kingdom of heaven is theirs? Well, we'd have to start with the Jewish view of heaven. And it's this: heaven is a place where everything is as God wills it to be. Heaven is a place where everything is as God wills it to be. It's this place that the Jews describe as a place of perfect shalom, which is a Hebrew word that means a place of peace, connectedness, and wholeness. Peace, connectedness, and wholeness. The kind that nobody can ever take away. And for the Jews, heaven is something that exists both now and later. Like, it's not just this thing that happens when we die, but it's this thing that we can experience in the midst of life. It's not just a place, but for the Jews, it was a place, it was a state of being, this heaven. This is what Jesus means when he prays, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." He means, like, in the midst of this fallen earth, may there be a piece of heaven that gets locked up inside of our hearts. I wonder if you've ever come to the realization that this is true. Jesus is literally saying that heaven is available when others are making our lives into a living hell. That God is present in those moments, that he's with us, that there's something about suffering for doing what's right that brings about this sense of shalom within, if we let it. That the reward for enduring persecution on the outside is peace, connectedness, and wholeness on the inside, because that's what your soul is actually thirsty for.
that, well, God doesn't inflict persecution. He infuses it with purpose. I don't know if you've had these moments where you realize that some of the greatest lessons you've ever learned and some of the biggest growth you've ever experienced happened as the result of things not going your way. When you have that realization, you know what it's called? Maturity. That one's for free, parents. That's what it is to be a grown-up. And maybe you've had that realization, like, man, like some of the greatest things that occurred to me, that I learned, that actually grew me up, were when things didn't happen the way I wanted them to. When the odds were stacked against me. When I was told something I didn't really want to hear at the time. When I didn't really get what I thought was owed me. When I thought I was being treated unfairly. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Others of you are just like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Maturity. And this is what I want to give you. I don't have time to go into all these in depth, but I want to just give you some handles on this, some ways that I think God allows persecution to produce shalom in our hearts. And the first one is this: persecution reveals what you're desperate enough for to dedicate yourself to. Persecution reveals what you're desperate enough for to dedicate yourself to. Man, when persecution clamps down on something you didn't really believe in, you're the first to leave, right? I'm all about this. It's going to be $50. You know, I wasn't that into it, right? As soon as there's like a cost on the table. I will do anything. I will die for you. Let's put you in front and start shooting bullets. You know what? I don't think we're meant to be together. You know what I mean? I don't know if you felt that in your spirit, but I definitely did. There's something about it, like, when you stick with something, when the persecution comes on, it's this, like, little indicator, like, this is really who I am. This is really what I value. This is what I'm made to do and be. The other thing that persecution does is, number two, is persecution will redefine what you see as realistic. Persecution will redefine what you see as realistic. Do you ever just think, like, man, there's no way I could do that? There's no way I could hurdle that. There's no way I could, like, start this business. There's no way I could make that happen. There's no way I could stand up to these people. And suddenly, the pressure's on, and you cling to God, and you're able to move past it, and you're like, oh, I can't believe how did I do that? I don't even know how I don't feel like I had the ability to do that. Well, now I feel like, well, what else is possible? What else does God want to use me to do? What else could I put myself out there and see God deliver on? And we begin, our mind begins to expand the possibilities of what God might want to do in and through our lives. The third thing is this: persecution will require you to rely on God. Persecution will require you to rely on God. Because when you hit rock bottom and you have nothing left, God is your only option. And in fact, it ends up probably being the best day of your life. If you're very familiar with, like, the recovery movement, the first step to actually experiencing healing in your life is experiencing enough loss in your world that you get to a place where you're like, we realize that we are powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable. What is that? It's a declaration of reliance on God. I can't do this. I'm at the end of me. And this is where God begins. And the fourth thing is this: persecution results in connection to and compassion for others. Persecution results in connection to and compassion for others. You ever been going through something that's really horrible? And somebody tried to help you or give you advice, and what was the one thing that you said to them? You don't know what it's like. But then somebody else comes along and they've been through that. They've been down that road. They've had that experience. And they don't pretend to know everything that you felt or everything that you've experienced, but they can say this: man, I've been there and it's excruciating. I'm so sorry. It cultivates this heart of compassion
I don't know if you've ever had these experiences in your life where you had this kind of judgment in your soul for a certain type of person or someone who did a certain type of thing until that same thing becomes true about your life and suddenly there's a whole lot of grace being given back to them, isn't there? Because when you've needed a certain amount of grace, it's so much easier to give it back out to somebody else in need because you know what it's like and it bonds you to people. It brings about connection in your world. And the truth is that choosing to do what's right over what's easy and following Jesus, even when it costs, has the power to change the world. And we know this is true because it already has. All these people that were sitting on the side of a mountain doubting that this was really true, that this counterintuitive message could actually be something that reshapes the world and connects people to peace and wholeness and connection. And yet the truth is that Rome came crashing down, but Christianity is here to stay. These early Christians were so focused on their inner world that they believed that God was cultivating on the inside of them, in their hearts and minds and souls, that when things went south circumstantially, there was this nonsensical joy that overflowed from their hearts. There was this peace that surpasses all understanding that flowed from the inside of them that people couldn't quite grip. And you couldn't crush them by trying to take things away from them because they were open-handed with everything they had. They'd just give it to you with a smile on their face. And you couldn't oppress them by forcing them to do slave labor for you because they tried that. But like they believed that any task they had was a gift from God. They worked their hardest. They gave their best. They went the extra mile, even for people they didn't like. I mean, you couldn't rile them up by insulting them because they embodied such humility that they were quick to self-examine and find the little fragment of truth in your big blown-out attack. And they would repent and repair any molecule of wrongdoing to restore the relationship. Because here's the truth. When you cultivate a deep connection with God on the inside, nothing on the outside can destroy you. You're blessed when you come to realize that the hell without can't corrupt the heaven within. And it all starts with surrender, with letting go. When Tegan came home from school, we had this big, long talk about these bullies and about the circumstances and about who she is and who she's not, about what to believe and what to push away, about how to navigate those situations. And I went back to her school and we played Foursquare because I'm kind of the king of Foursquare there. I don't want to brag, but it's kind of super true. I'm like King Square like every time. I don't want to go into it, but I'm awesome. So I'm just saying, don't try double bouncies on me because that's totally illegal and we play by the real rules when I'm the King Square. And so I'm there and I'm playing Foursquare and I see out of the corner of my eye that Tegan is off in the distance and I see this girl that's moving in her direction and I see her look up at me and there's that moment of, what should I do? I mean, do I need to abandon this guy? And what's she gonna do? And I got to stand there and have her see that I'm with her and I'm there and I'm in the midst of it, but not step in and not absorb all the consequences and not prevent what was about to happen. And I watched her from a distance have this conversation and then walk away with a smile on her face. And there was this huge sense of pride that swelled up within me. Because I've been through enough persecution to know that there's something beautiful when someone doesn't come in and do everything for you, but in which they tell you who you are and empower you to do what needs to be done. I got to see that day. I got to stand at a distance and make eye contact with my daughter in the way that says all the things I said to her one-on-one, that I'm with you, that I'm for you. You can do this. That regardless of what happens next, I love you. I'll be there for you. You're mine. Even if nobody else knows the truth, I know the truth. And I see you. And I will reward you. And as long as I'm involved, your story won't ever end poorly, because I don't do happy endings in my house. And here's what I want you to know is true about God today. The Bible makes this promise, not that God will bail you out every time you hit a wall, but he promises you this, that he is with you, that he's for you, that with his help, you can do this, that regardless of what happens next, that he loves you, that he'll be there for you, that you're his, that no matter what anybody else says, he knows the truth, that he sees you, he sees what you do in secret. He knows what's real, and he will reward you. And as long as he's involved, your story won't ever end poorly, because God doesn't do happy endings, unhappy endings when it comes to his children. It's not who he is. That in the end, the righteous do prevail. And it doesn't always look like a material circumstance, but it does always look like heaven on the inside of your heart and your mind. A moment in which everything is falling apart except you, because you're clinging to the one that has your back. I want to pray for you this morning. How many of you would just be honest and just say, you've experienced some really hard stuff for trying to do the right thing? Anybody in here? And I would just tell you this, as your pastor, if you can't raise your hand, you're probably not trying hard enough to do the right thing. Because it pushes people's buttons, even when you do it in the right way. And I want to pray for you today, because I want to pray that even in the midst of that, if none of the circumstances change, that there would be this peace and this connectedness deep down in your soul, that you would have this sense of wholeness because of the interior life that God is cultivating in you, and that it would spill out on your family, in your neighborhoods, in your workplaces, and that people would say, I have no idea what's going on with them, but they've got life figured out. Why don't you bow your heads across this room with me? Father, I thank you so much for who you are. God, for your grace and your love and your mercy. I'm so thankful that you give to us of yourself unconditionally. God, we are all in this room because of your grace. And yet we struggle, God. We want to be like you, and we all fall short, but there are these moments that rip up our heart, because we're trying to do what is right, what is honoring to you. We're trying to follow you, and yet sometimes we feel like you've led us into this place in which it's just chaotic and it's crazy, and we're suffering the consequences of just trying to be who we feel like you've called us to be. And God, I pray that in the midst of those moments that we would cling to you, that we would throw up our hands in surrender, that we would stop trying to figure out how to make all the circumstances in our life be exactly how we wish they were. But God, we would surrender to your purpose and plan for our life. And God, as we cling to you, even as a hell might rage on around us, that the heaven within us would sustain our souls. And God, I pray that there would be this joy that cannot be described. There would be a peace that doesn't make sense, that we would experience what the early church did, this sense of, even in the midst of persecution, experiencing the deepest of blessing. God, I pray a blessing on everyone's life here, that as they move towards you and as they trip and fall and stumble, God, that you would let them know that you are with them and that you are for them, and that with your help, they can do more than survive. They can thrive. We ask these things in your name, Father. And everybody said, amen.